cosmic consciousness. Our flesh will be charged with such magnetism that wild animals of the Himalayas will come tamely near us. Tigers will be no more than meek house cats awaiting our caresses. This remark, picturing a prospect I considered entrancing, both metaphorically and literally, brought an enthusiastic smile from Amar. But Jatinder averted his gaze, directing it through the window at the scampering landscape. "Let the money be divided in three portions," Jatinder broke a long silence with this suggestion. "Each of us should buy his own ticket at Burdwan. Thus, no one at the station will surmise that we are running away together." I unsuspectingly agreed. At dusk, our train stopped at Burdwan. Jatinder entered the ticket office. Amar and I sat on the platform. We waited 15 minutes, then made unavailing inquiries. Searching in all directions, we shouted Jatinder's name with the urgency of fright, but he'd faded into the dark unknown surrounding the little station. I was completely unnerved, shocked to a peculiar numbness, that God would countenance this depressing episode. The romantic occasion of my first carefully planned flight after him was cruelly marred. "Amar, we must return home." I was weeping like a child. "Jatinder's callous departure is an ill omen. This trip is doomed to failure." "Is this your love for the Lord? Can't you stand the little test of a treacherous companion?" Through Amar's suggestion of a divine test, my heart steadied itself. We refreshed ourselves with famous Burdwan sweetmeats, Sitabhog, food for the goddess, and motichur, nuggets of sweet pearl. In a few hours we entrained for Hardwar via Bareilly. Changing trains the following day at Mogul Serai, we discussed a vital matter as we waited on the platform. "Amar, we may soon be closely questioned by railroad officials. I am not underrating my brother's ingenuity. No matter what the outcome, I will not speak untruth." "All I ask of you, Mukunda, is to keep still. Don't laugh or grin while I'm talking." At this moment, a European station agent accosted me. He waved a telegram whose import I immediately grasped. "Are you running away from home in anger?" "No." I was glad his choice of words permitted me to make emphatic reply. "Not anger, but divinest melancholy was responsible, I knew, for my unconventional behaviour." The official then turned to Amar. The duel of wits that followed hardly permitted me to maintain the counselled, stoic gravity. "Where is the third boy?" The man injected a full ring of authority into his voice. "Come now, speak the truth." "Sir, I notice you are wearing eyeglasses. Can't you see that we are only two?" Amar smiled impudently. "I am not a magician. I can't conjure up a third boy." The official, noticeably disconcerted by this impertinence, sought a new field of attack. "What is your name?" "I am called Thomas. I am the son of an English mother and a converted Christian Indian father." "What is your friend's name?"
"I call him Thompson."
By this time, my inward mirth had reached a zenith. I unceremoniously made for the train, which was providentially whistling for departure. Amar followed with the official, who was credulous and obliging enough to put us into a European compartment. It evidently pained him to think of two half-English boys travelling in the section allotted to natives. After his polite exit, I lay back on the seat and laughed uproariously. Amar wore an expression of blithe satisfaction at having outwitted a veteran European official. On the platform, I had contrived to read the telegram. From my brother Ananta it went thus. 3 Bengali boys, in English clothes, running away from home towards Hardwar via Mughal Serai. Please detain them until my arrival. Ample reward for your services. Amar, I told you not to leave marked timetables in your home.
My glance was reproachful. Brother must have found one there.
My friend sheepishly acknowledged the thrust. We halted briefly in Bareilly, where Dwarka Prasad awaited us with a telegram from Ananta. Dwarka tried valiantly to detain us. I convinced him that our flight had not been undertaken lightly. As on a previous occasion, Dwarka refused my invitation to set out for the Himalayas. While our train stood in the station that night, and I was half asleep, Amar was awakened by another questioning official. He, too, fell a victim to the hybrid charms of Thomas and Thompson. The train bore us triumphantly into a dawn arrival at Hardwar. The majestic mountains loomed invitingly in the distance. We dashed through the station and entered the freedom of city crowds. Our first act was to change into native costume, as Ananta had somehow penetrated our European disguise. A premonition of capture weighed on my mind. Deeming it advisable to leave Hardwar at once, we bought tickets to proceed north, to Rishikesh, a soil long hallowed by the feet of many masters. I had already boarded the train, while Amara lagged on the platform. He was brought to an abrupt halt by a shout from a policeman. An unwelcome guardian, the officer escorted Amara and me to a police station bungalow and took charge of our money. He explained courteously that it was his duty to hold us until my elder brother arrived. Learning that the truant's destination had been the Himalayas, the officer related a strange story. "I see you are crazy about saints. You will never meet a greater man of God than the one I saw only yesterday. My brother officer and I first encountered him 5 days ago. We were patrolling by the Ganges, on a sharp lookout for a certain murderer. Our instructions were to capture him, dead or alive. He was known to be masquerading as a sadhu in order to rob pilgrims. A short way before us, we spied a figure which resembled the description of the criminal. He ignored our command to stop. We ran to overpower him. Approaching his back, I wielded my axe with tremendous force. The man's right arm was severed almost completely from his body. Without outcry or glance at the ghastly wound, the stranger astonishingly continued his swift pace. As we jumped in front of him, he spoke quietly. "I am not the murderer you are seeking." I was deeply mortified to see that I had injured the person of a divine-looking sage. Prostrating myself at his feet, I implored his pardon and offered my turban cloth to staunch the heavy spurts of blood.
"Son, that was just an understandable mistake on your part."
The saint regarded me kindly.
"Run along, and don't reproach yourself. The beloved mother is taking care of me."
He pushed his dangling arm into its stump, and lo, it adhered. The blood inexplicably ceased to flow. "Come to me under yonder tree in 3 days, and you will find me fully healed. Thus you will feel no remorse." Yesterday my brother officer and I went eagerly to the designated spot. The sadhu was there and allowed us to examine his arm. It bore no scar nor trace of hurt. "I am going via Rishikesh to the Himalayan solitudes." The sadhu blessed us as he departed quickly. I feel that my life has been uplifted through his sanctity. The officer concluded with a pious ejaculation. His experience had obviously moved him beyond his usual depths. With an impressive gesture, he handed me a printed clipping about the miracle. In the usual garbled manner of the sensational type of newspaper, not missing, alas, even in India, the reporter's version was slightly exaggerated. It indicated that the sadhu had been almost decapitated. Amar and I lamented that we had missed the great yogi who could forgive his persecutor in such a Christ-like way. India, materially poor for the last 2 centuries, yet has an inexhaustible fund of divine wealth. Spiritual skyscrapers may occasionally be encountered by the wayside, even by worldly men like this policeman. We thanked the officer for relieving our tedium with his marvellous story. He was probably intimating that he was more fortunate than we.
He had met an illuminated saint without effort. Our earnest search had ended not at the feet of a master, but in a coarse police station. So near the Himalayas, and yet in our captivity so far, I told Amar I felt doubly impelled to seek freedom. Let us slip away when opportunity offers. We can go on foot to holy Rishikesh, I smiled encouragingly. But my companion had turned pessimist as soon as the stalwart prop of our money had been taken from us. If we started a trek over such dangerous jungle land, we should finish not in the city of saints, but in the stomachs of tigers. Ananta and Amar's brother arrived after 3 days. Amar greeted his relative with affectionate relief. I was unreconciled. Ananta got no more from me than a severe upbraiding. I understand how you feel, my brother spoke soothingly. All I ask of you is to accompany me to Banaras to meet a certain sage and go on to Calcutta to visit our grieving father for a few days. Then you may resume your search here for a master. Amar entered the conversation at this point to disclaim any intention of returning to Ardvar with me. He was enjoying the familial warmth, but I knew I would never abandon the quest for my guru. Our party entrained for Banaras. There I had a singular and instant response to a prayer. A clever scheme had been prearranged by Ananta. Before seeing me in Ardvar, he had stopped in Banaras to ask a scriptural authority to interview me later. The pundit and his son also had promised Ananta that they would attempt to dissuade me from becoming a sannyasi. Ananta took me to their home. The son, a young man of ebullient manner, greeted me in the courtyard. He engaged me in a lengthy philosophical discourse. Professing to have a clairvoyant knowledge of my future, he discountenanced my idea of being a monk. You will meet continual misfortune and be unable to find God if you insist on deserting your ordinary responsibilities. You cannot work out your past karma without worldly experiences. Immortal words from the Bhagavad Gita rose to my lips in reply. Even he, with the worst of karma, who ceaselessly meditates on me, quickly loses the effects of his past bad actions. Becoming a high-souled being, he soon attains perennial peace. Know this for certain, the devotee who puts his trust in me never perishes. But the forceful prognostications of the young man had slightly shaken my confidence. With all the fervor of my heart, I prayed silently to God, please solve my bewilderment and answer me right here and now. If thou dost desire me to lead the life of a renunciant or a worldly man. I noticed a sadhu of noble countenance standing just outside the compound of the pundit's house. Evidently, he had overheard the spirited conversation between the self-styled clairvoyant and me, for the stranger called me to his side. I felt a tremendous power flowing from his calm eyes.
Son, don't listen to that ignoramus. In response to your prayer, the Lord tells me to assure you that your sole path in this life is that of the renunciant.
With astonishment as well as gratitude, I smiled happily at this decisive message.
Come away from that man, the ignoramus was calling me from the courtyard. My saintly guide raised his hand in blessing and slowly departed. That sadhu is just as crazy as you are. It was the hoary-headed pundit who made this charming observation.
He and his son were gazing at me lugubriously. I have heard that he too has left his home in a vague search for God. I turned away. To Ananta I remarked that I would not engage in further discussion with our hosts. My discouraged brother agreed to an immediate departure. We soon entrained for Calcutta. Mr. Detective, how did you discover that I had fled with two companions? I vented my lively curiosity to Ananta during our homeward journey. He smiled mischievously. At your school, I found that Ahmad had left his classroom and had not returned. I went to his home the next morning and unearthed a marked timetable. Ahmad's father was just leaving by carriage and was talking to the coachman.
My son will not ride with me to his school this morning. He's disappeared, the father moaned. I heard from a brother coachman that your son and two others dressed in European suits boarded the train at Howrah Station, the man stated. They made a present of their leather shoes to the cab driver. Thus I had three clues, the timetable, the trio of boys, and the English clothing.
I was listening to Ananta's disclosures with mingled mirth and vexation. Our generosity to the coachman had been slightly misplaced. Of course, I rushed to send telegrams to station officials in all the cities that Ahmad had underlined in the timetable. He had checked Bareilly, so I wired your friend Dwarka there. After inquiries in our Calcutta neighbourhood, I learned that cousin Jatinder had been absent one night, but had arrived home the following morning in European garb. I sought him out and invited him to dinner. He accepted, quite disarmed by my friendly manner. On the way, I led him unsuspectingly to a police station. He was surrounded by several officers whom I had previously selected for their ferocious appearance. Under their formidable gaze, Jatinder agreed to account for his mysterious conduct. I started for the Himalayas in a buoyant spiritual mood, he explained. Inspiration filled me at the prospect of meeting the masters, but as soon as Mukunda said, during our ecstasies in the Himalayan caves, tigers will be spellbound and sit around us like tame pussies, my spirits froze. Beads of perspiration formed on my brow. What then, I thought, if the vicious nature of the tigers be not changed through the power of our spiritual trance, shall they treat us with the kindness of house cats? In my mind's eye, I already saw myself the compulsory inmate of some tiger's stomach, entering there not at once with the whole body, but by installments of its several parts. My anger at Jatinder's vanishment evaporated in laughter. The hilarious explanation on the train was worth all the anguish he had caused me. I must confess to a slight feeling of satisfaction. Jatinder, too, had not escaped an encounter with the police. Ananta, you're a born sleuth-hound. My glance of amusement was not without some exasperation. And I shall tell Jatinder I am glad he was prompted by no mood of treachery, as it appeared, but only by the prudent instincts of self-preservation. At home, in Calcutta, Father touchingly requested me to curb my roving feet until at least the completion of my high school studies. In my absence, he had lovingly hatched a plot by arranging for a saintly pundit, Swami K. Balananda, to come regularly to the house. The sage will be your Sanskrit tutor, my parent announced confidently. Father hoped to satisfy my religious yearnings by instruction from a learned philosopher. But the tables were subtly turned. My new teacher, far from offering intellectual aridities, fanned the embers of my God aspiration. Unknown to Father, Swami Kebalananda was an exalted disciple of Lahiri Mahashai. The peerless guru had possessed thousands of disciples, silently drawn to him by the irresistibility of his divine magnetism. I learned later that Lahiri Mahashai had often characterized Kebalananda as rishi, or illuminated sage. Luxuriant curls framed my tutor's handsome face. His dark eyes were guileless with the transparency of a child's. All the movements of his slight body were marked by a restful deliberation. Ever gentle and loving, he was firmly established in the infinite consciousness. Many of our happy hours together were spent in deep Kriya meditation. Kebalananda was a noted authority on the ancient Shastras or sacred books. His erudition had earned him the title of Shastri Mahashai, by which he was usually addressed, but my progress in Sanskrit scholarship was unnoteworthy. I sought every opportunity to forsake prosaic grammar and to talk of yoga and Lahiri Mahashai. My tutor obliged me one day by telling me something of his own life with the master. Rarely fortunate, I was able to remain near Lahiri Mahashai for 10 years. His Banaras home was my nightly goal of pilgrimage. The guru was always present in a small front parlour on the first floor. As he sat in lotus posture on a backless wooden seat, his disciples garlanded him in a semicircle. His eyes sparkled and danced with the joy of the divine. They were ever half-closed, peering through the inner telescopic orb into a sphere of eternal bliss. He seldom spoke at length. Occasionally, his gaze would focus on a student in need of help. Healing words poured then like an avalanche of light. An indescribable peace blossomed within me at the master's glance. I was permeated with his fragrance, as though from a lotus of infinity. To be with him, even without exchanging a word for days, was experience which changed my entire being. If any invisible barrier rose in the path of my concentration, I would meditate at the Guru's feet. There, the most tenuous states came easily within my grasp. Such perceptions eluded me in the presence of lesser teachers. The Master was a living temple of God, whose secret doors were open to all disciples through devotion. Lahiri Mahashai was no bookish interpreter of the scriptures. Effortlessly he dipped into the divine library. Foam of words and spray of thoughts gushed from the fountain of his omniscience. He had the wondrous clavis that unlocked the profound philosophical science hidden ages ago in the Vedas. If asked to explain the different planes of consciousness mentioned in the ancient texts, he would smilingly assent. I will undergo those states and presently tell you what I perceive. He was thus diametrically unlike the teachers who commit scripture to memory and then give forth unrealized abstractions. Please expound the holy stanzas as the meaning occurs to you. The taciturn guru often gave this instruction to a nearby disciple. I will guide your thoughts, that the right interpretation be uttered. In this way, many of Lahiri Mahasaya's perceptions came to be recorded with voluminous commentaries by various students. The master never counseled slavish belief. Words are only shells, he said. Win conviction of God's presence through your own joyous contact in meditation. No matter what the disciple's problem, the guru advised Kriya Yoga for its solution. The yogic key will not lose its efficiency when I am no longer present in the body to guide you. This technique cannot be bound, filed, and forgotten in the manner of theoretical inspirations. Continue ceaselessly on your path to liberation through Kriya, whose power lies in practice. I myself consider Kriya the most effective device of salvation through self-effort ever to be evolved in man's search for the infinite. Kabbalananda concluded with this earnest testimony. Through its use, the omnipotent God, hidden in all men, became visibly incarnated in the flesh of Lahiri Mahashai and of a number of his disciples. A Christ-like miracle by Lahiri Mahashai took place in Kabbalananda's presence. My saintly tutor recounted the story one day, his eyes remote from the Sanskrit texts, on the table before us. A blind disciple, Ramu, aroused my active pity. Should he have no light in his eyes, when he faithfully served our master, in whom the divine was fully blazing? One morning I sought to speak to Ramu, but he sat for patient hours, fanning the guru with a handmade palm-leaf punkha. When the devotee finally left the room, I followed him. Ramu, how long have you been blind?
From my birth, sir, never have my eyes been blessed with a glimpse of the sun. Our omnipotent Guru can help you. Please make a supplication. The following day, Ramu diffidently approached Lahiri Mahashai. The disciple felt almost ashamed to ask that physical wealth be added to his spiritual superabundance. Master, the illuminator of the cosmos is in you. I pray you to bring his light into my eyes, that I perceive the sun's lesser glow. Ramu, someone has connived to put me in a difficult position. I have no healing power. Sir, the Infinite One within you can certainly heal. That is indeed different, Ramu. God's limit is nowhere. He who ignites the stars and the cells of flesh with mysterious life effulgence can surely bring the luster of vision into your eyes. The Master touched Ramu's forehead at the point between the eyebrows. Keep your mind concentrated there, and frequently chant the name of the prophet Rama for 7 days. The splendor of the sun shall have a special dawn for you. Lo, in 1 week it was so. For the first time, Ramu beheld the fair face of nature. The Omniscient One had unerringly directed his disciple to repeat the name of Rama, adorned by him above all other saints. Ramu's faith was the devotionally ploughed soil in which the Guru's powerful seed of permanent healing sprouted. Kebalananda was silent for a moment, then paid a further tribute to his Guru. It was evident in all miracles performed by Lahiri Mahashai that he never allowed the ego principle to consider itself a causative force. By the perfection of his surrender to the prime healing power, the Master enabled it to flow freely through him. The numerous bodies that were spectacularly healed through Lahiri Mahashai eventually had to feed the flames of cremation, but the silent spiritual awakenings he effected, the Christ-like disciples he fashioned, are his imperishable miracles. I never became a Sanskrit scholar. Kebalananda taught me a diviner syntax. Chapter 5. A Perfume Saint Displays His Wonders. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. I did not have this wisdom of Solomon to comfort me. I gazed searchingly about me, on any excursion from home, for the face of my destined guru. But my path did not cross his until after the completion of my high school studies. 2 years elapsed between my flight with Amar towards the Himalayas and the great day of Sri Yukteswar's arrival into my life. During that interim, I met a number of sages, the Perfume Saint, the Tiger Swami, Nagendranath Baduri, Master Mahashai, and the famous Bengali scientist Jagadish Chandra Bose. My encounter with the Perfume Saint had two preambles, one harmonious and the other humorous. God is simple, everything else is complex. Do not seek absolute values in the relative world of nature. These philosophical finalities gently entered my ear as I stood silently before a temple image of Kali. Turning, I confronted a tall man whose garb, or lack of it, revealed him a wandering sadhu. "You have indeed penetrated the bewilderment of my thoughts," I smiled gratefully. "The confusion of benign and terrible aspects in nature, as symbolized by Kali, has puzzled wiser heads than mine. Few there be who solve her mystery. Good and evil is the challenging riddle which life places sphinx-like before every intelligence. Attempting no solution, most men pay forfeit with their lives, penalty now even as in the days of Thebes. Here and there, a towering lonely figure never cries defeat. From the Maya of duality, he plucks the cleaveless truth of unity.
You speak with conviction, sir. I have long exercised an honest introspection, the exquisitely painful approach to wisdom, self-scrutiny, relentless observance of one's thoughts, is a stark and shattering experience. It pulverizes the stoutest ego, but true self-analysis mathematically operates to produce seers. The way of self-expression, individual acknowledgements, results in egotists. Sure of the right to their private interpretation of God and the universe. Truth humbly retires, no doubt, before such arrogant originality. I was enjoying the discussion. Man can understand no eternal verity until he has freed himself from pretensions. The human mind, bared to a centuried slime, is teeming with the repulsive life of countless world delusions. Struggles of the battlefield pale into insignificance here, when man first contends with inner enemies. No mortal foes these to be overcome by a harrowing array of might. Omnipresent, unresting, pursuing man even in sleep, subtly equipped with miasmic weapons, these soldiers of ignorant lusts seek to slay us all. Thoughtless is the man who buries his ideals, surrendering to the common fate. May he seem other than impotent, wooden, ignominious? Respected sir, have you no sympathy for the bewildered masses? The sage was silent for a moment, then answered obliquely, "To love both the invisible God, repository of all virtues, and visible man, apparently possessed of none, is often baffling, but ingenuity is equal to the maze. Inner research soon exposes a unity of all human minds, the stalwart kinship of selfish motive. In one sense at least, the brotherhood of man stands revealed. An aghast humility follows this levelling discovery. It ripens into compassion for one's fellows, blind to the healing potencies of the soul awaiting exploration. The saints of every age, sir, have felt like yourself for the sorrows of the world. Only the shallow man loses responsiveness to the woes of others' lives, as he sinks into narrow suffering of his own. The sadhu's austere face was noticeably softened. The one who practices a scalpel, self-dissection, will know an expansion of universal pity. Release is given him from the deafening demands of his ego. The love of God flowers on such soil. The creature finally turns to his Creator, if for no other reason than to ask in anguish, "Why, Lord, why?" By ignoble whips of pain, man is driven at last into the infinite presence, whose beauty alone should lure him. The sage and I were present in the Calcutta Kalighat temple, whither I had gone to view its famed magnificence. With a sweeping gesture, my chance companion dismissed the ornate dignity. Bricks and mortar sing us no audible tune. The heart opens only to the human chant of being. We strolled to the inviting sunshine at the entrance, where throngs of devotees were passing to and fro. "You are young," the sage surveyed me thoughtfully. "India, too, is young." The ancient rishis laid down ineradicable patterns of spiritual living. Their hoary dictums suffice for this day and land, not outmoded, not unsophisticated against the guiles of materialism. The disciplinary precepts mould India still. By millenniums, more than embarrassed scholars care to compute, the sceptic time has validated Vedic worth. Take it for your heritage. As I was reverently bidding farewell to the eloquent sadhu, he revealed a clairvoyant perception. "After you leave here today, an unusual experience will come your way." I quitted the temple precincts, and wandered along aimlessly. Turning a corner, I ran into an old acquaintance, one of those fellows whose conversational powers ignore time and embrace eternity. "I shall let you go in a very short while," he promised, "if you will tell me all that has happened during the years of our separation." What a paradox! I must leave you now. But he held me by the hand, forcing out tidbits of information. He was like a ravenous wolf, I thought in amusement. The longer I spoke, the more hungrily he sniffed for news. Inwardly, I petitioned the goddess Kali to devise a graceful means of escape. My companion left me abruptly. I sighed with relief and doubled my pace, dreading any relapse into the garrulous fever. Hearing rapid footsteps behind me, I quickened my speed. I dared not look back, but with a bound the youth rejoined me, jovially clasping my shoulder. "I forgot to tell you of Gunda Baba, perfume saint, who is gracing yonder house." He pointed to a dwelling a few yards distant. "Do meet him. He's interesting. You may have an unusual experience. Goodbye." And he actually left me. The similarly worded prediction of the sadhu at Kalighat temple flashed through my mind. Intrigued, I entered the house and was ushered into a commodious parlour. A crowd of people were sitting, orient-wise, here and there on a thick orange-coloured carpet. An awed whisper reached my ear. "Behold, Gunda Baba, on the leopard skin. He can give the natural perfume of any flower to a scentless one, or revive a wilted blossom, or make a person's skin exude delightful fragrance." I looked directly at the saint. His quick gaze rested on mine. He was plump and bearded, with dark skin and large, gleaming eyes. "Son, I am glad to see you. Say what you want. Would you like some perfume?" "What for?" I thought his remark rather childish. "To experience the miraculous way of enjoying perfumes." "Harnessing God to make odours?" "What of it? God makes perfumes anyway." "Yes, but he fashions frail bottles of petals for fresh use and discard. Can you materialise flowers?" "Yes, but usually I produce perfumes, little friend." "Then scent factories will go out of business." "I will permit them to keep their trade. My own purpose is to demonstrate the power of God."
"Sir, is it necessary to prove God? Isn't he performing miracles in everything, everywhere?"
"Yes, but we too should manifest some of his infinite creative variety."
"How long did it take you to master your art?"
12 years.
"For manufacturing scents by astral means, it seems, my honoured saint, you've been wasting 12 years for fragrances which you can obtain with a few rupees from a florist's shop."
"Perfumes fade with flowers."
"Perfumes fade with death. Why should I desire that which pleases the body only?"
"Mr. Philosopher, you please my mind. Now, stretch forth your right hand."
He made a gesture of blessing. I was a few feet away from Gunda Baba. No one else was near enough to contact my body. I extended my hand, which the yogi did not touch.
"What perfume do you want?"
"Rose."
"Be it so."
To my great surprise, the charming fragrance of rose was wafted strongly from the centre of my palm. I smilingly took a large white scentless flower from a nearby vase. "Can this odourless blossom be permeated with jasmine?"
"Be it so."
A jasmine fragrance instantly shot from the petals. I thanked the wonder worker and seated myself by one of his students. He informed me that Gunda Baba, whose proper name was Vishuddhananda, had learned many astonishing yoga secrets from a master in Tibet. The Tibetan yogi, I was assured, had attained the age of over 1,000 years. His disciple, Gunda Baba, does not always perform his perfume feats in the simple verbal manner you have just witnessed. The student spoke with obvious pride in his master. His procedure differs widely to accord with diversity in temperaments. He is marvellous. Many members of the Calcutta intelligentsia are among his followers. I inwardly resolved not to add myself to their number. A guru too literally marvellous was not to my liking. With polite thanks to Ganda Baba, I departed. Sauntering home, I reflected on the three varied encounters the day had brought forth. My sister Uma met me as I entered the door. "You are getting quite stylish, using perfumes." Without a word, I motioned her to smell my hand. "What an attractive rose fragrance. It is unusually strong." Thinking it was strongly unusual, I silently placed the astrally scented blossom under her nostrils. "Oh, I love jasmine." She seized the flower. A ludicrous bafflement passed over her face as she repeatedly sniffed the odour of jasmine from a type of flower she well knew to be scentless. Her reactions disarmed my suspicion that Ganda Baba might have induced in me an autosuggestive state whereby I alone could detect the fragrances. Later I heard from a friend, Alakananda, that the perfume saint had a power which I wish were possessed by the starving millions of the world. I was present with 100 other guests at Ganda Baba's home in Burdwan, Alakananda told me. It was a gala occasion. Because the yogi was reputed to have the power of extracting objects out of thin air, I laughingly requested him to materialize some out-of-season tangerines. Immediately, the luchis that had been served on all the banana leaf plates became puffed up. Each of the bread envelopes proved to contain a peeled tangerine. I bit into my own with some trepidation, but found it delicious. Years later, I understood by inner realization how Ganda Baba accomplished his materializations. The method, alas, is beyond the reach of the world's hungry hordes. The different sensory stimuli to which man reacts, tactual, visual, gustatory, auditory, and olfactory, are produced by vibratory variations in electrons and protons. The vibrations, in turn, are regulated by prana, lifetrons, subtle life forces or finer-than-atomic energies, intelligently charged with the five distinctive sensory idea substances. Ganda Baba, attuning himself with the pranic force by certain yoga practices, was able to guide the lifetrons to rearrange their vibratory structure and to objectify the desired result. His perfume, fruit, and other miracles were actual materializations of mundane vibrations, and were not inner sensations hypnotically produced. Hypnotism has been used by physicians in minor operations as a sort of psychical chloroform for persons who might be endangered by an anesthetic, but a hypnotic state is harmful to those often subjected to it. A negative psychological effect ensues that in time deranges the brain cells. Hypnotism is trespass into the territory of another's consciousness. Its temporary phenomena have nothing in common with the miracles performed by men of divine realization. Awake in God, true saints effect changes in this dream world by means of a will harmoniously attuned to the creative cosmic dreamer. Wonder workings, such as those shown by the perfume saint, are spectacular, but spiritually useless. Having little purpose beyond entertainment, they are digressions from a serious search for God. Ostentatious display of unusual powers is decried by masters. The Persian mystic Abu Sa'id once laughed at certain fakirs, Muslim ascetics, who were proud of their miraculous powers over water, air, and space. "A frog is also at home in the water," Abu Sa'id pointed out in gentle scorn. "The crow and the vulture easily fly in the air. The devil is simultaneously present in the east and in the west. A true man is he who dwells in righteousness among his fellow men, who may buy and sell, yet is never for a single instant forgetful of God." On another occasion, the great Persian teacher gave his views on the religious life thus: "To lay aside what you have in your head, selfish desires and ambitions, to bestow freely what you have in your hand, and never to flinch from the blows of adversity." Neither the impartial sage at Kalighat Temple nor the Tibetan-trained yogi had satisfied my yearnings for a guru. My heart needed no tutor for its recognitions, and cried a spontaneous bravo, the more resoundingly because it was unoften summoned from silence. When I finally met my master, by sublimity of example alone he taught me the measure of a true man.
Chapter 6. The Tiger Swami. I have discovered the Tiger Swami's address. Let us visit him tomorrow. This welcome suggestion came from Chandi, one of my high school friends. I was eager to meet the saint who, in his pre-monastic life, had caught and fought tigers with his naked hands. A boyish enthusiasm over such remarkable feats was strong within me. The next day dawned wintry cold, but Chandi and I sallied forth gaily. After much vain hunting in Bhawanipur, outside Calcutta, we arrived at the right house. The door held two iron rings, which I sounded piercingly. Notwithstanding the clamour, a servant approached with a leisurely gait. His ironical smile implied that noisy visitors were powerless to disturb the calmness of a saint's home. Feeling the silent rebuke, my companion and I were thankful to be invited into the parlour. Our long wait there beset us with misgivings. India's unwritten law for the truth-seeker is patience. A master may purposely make a test of one's eagerness to meet him. This psychological ruse is freely employed in the West by doctors and dentists. Finally, summoned by the servant, Chandi and I entered a sleeping apartment. The famous Sohong Swami was seated on his bed. The sight of his tremendous body affected us strangely. With bulging eyes, we stood speechless. We'd never before seen such a chest, or such football-like biceps. On an immense neck, the Swami's fierce yet calm face was adorned with flowing locks, beard, and moustache. A hint of dove-like and tiger-like qualities shone in his dark eyes. He was unclothed, save for a tiger skin about his muscular waist. Finding our voices, my friend and I greeted the monk, expressing our admiration for his prowess in the extraordinary feline arena. "Will you not tell us, please, how it is possible to subdue, with bare fists, the most ferocious of jungle beasts, the Royal Bengals?" "My sons, it is nothing to me to fight tigers. I could do it today, if necessary." He gave a childlike laugh. "You look upon tigers as tigers. I know them as pussycats." "Swamiji, I think I could impress my subconsciousness with the thought that the tigers are pussycats, but could I make tigers believe it?" "Of course, strength is also necessary. One may not expect victory from a baby who imagines a tiger to be a house cat. Powerful hands are my sufficient weapon."
He asked us to follow him to the patio, where he struck the edge of a wall. A brick crashed to the floor. The sky peered boldly through the gape, the lost tooth space in the wall. I staggered in astonishment. He who can remove a mortared brick from a solid wall with one blow, I thought, must surely be able to displace the teeth of tigers.
"A number of men have physical power such as mine, but still lack in cool confidence. Those who are bodily but not mentally stalwart may find themselves fainting at the mere sight of a wild beast bounding freely in the jungle. The tiger, in its natural ferocity and habitat, is vastly different from the opium-fed circus animal. Many a man with Herculean strength has nonetheless been terrorized into abject helplessness before the onslaught of a Royal Bengal. Thus, the tiger has converted the man in his own mind to a state as fearful as the pussycats.
It is possible for a man owning a fairly strong body and an immensely strong determination to turn the tables on the tiger and force it to a conviction of pussycat defencelessness. How often have I done just that?
I was quite willing to believe that the titan before me was able to perform the tiger-pussycat metamorphosis. He seemed to be in a didactic mood. Chandy and I listened respectfully.
Mind is the wielder of muscles. The force of a hammer blow depends on the energy applied. The power expressed by a man's bodily instrument depends on his aggressive will and courage. The body is literally manufactured and sustained by mind. Through pressure of instincts from past lives, strengths or weaknesses percolate gradually into human consciousness. They express as habits, which in turn manifest as a desirable or an undesirable body. Outward frailty has a mental origin. In a vicious circle, the habit-bound body thwarts the mind. If the master allows himself to be commanded by a servant, the latter becomes autocratic. The mind is similarly enslaved by submitting to bodily dictation.
At our entreaty, the impressive Swami consented to tell us something of his own life.
My earliest ambition was to fight tigers. My will was mighty, but my body was feeble.
An ejaculation of surprise broke from me. It appeared incredible that this man now, with Atlantean shoulders fit to bear, could ever have known weakness. It was by indomitable persistency in thoughts of health and strength that I overcame my handicap. I have every reason to extol the compelling mental vigour which I found to be the real subduer of Royal Bengals. Do you think, revered Swami, that I could ever fight tigers? This was the first time and the last that the bizarre ambition ever visited my mind.
Yes, he was smiling, but there are many kinds of tigers. Some roam in jungles of human desires. No spiritual benefit accrues by knocking beasts unconscious. Rather be victor over the inner prowlers.
May we hear, sir, how you changed from a tamer of wild tigers to a tamer of wild passions? The tiger Swami fell into silence. Remoteness came into his gaze, summoning visions of bygone years. I discerned his slight mental struggle to decide whether to grant my request. Finally he smiled in acquiescence.
When my fame reached a zenith, it brought the intoxication of pride. I decided not only to fight tigers, but to display them in various tricks. My ambition was to force savage beasts to behave like domesticated ones. I began to perform my feats publicly, with gratifying success. One evening my father entered my room, in pensive mood. "Son, I have words of warning. I would save you from coming ills produced by the grinding wheels of cause and effect." "Are you a fatalist, father? Should superstition be allowed to discolour the powerful waters of my activities?" "I am no fatalist, son. But I believe in the just law of retribution, as taught in the Holy Scriptures. There is resentment against you in the jungle family. Sometime it may act to your cost."
"Father, you astonish me. You well know what tigers are, beautiful but merciless. Who knows, my blows may inject some slight sanity of consideration into their thick heads. I am headmaster in a forest finishing school to teach them gentler manners."
"Please, father, think of me as tiger tamer and never as tiger killer. How could my good actions bring ill upon me? I beg you not to impose any command that I change my way of life."
Chandy and I were all attention, understanding the past dilemma. In India, a child does not lightly disobey his parents' wishes. The tiger Swami went on.
"In stoic silence, father listened to my explanation. He followed it with a disclosure which he uttered gravely. "Son, you compel me to relate an ominous prediction from the lips of a saint. He approached me yesterday as I sat on the veranda in my daily meditation.
Dear friend, I come with a message for your belligerent son. Let him cease his savage activities. Otherwise, his next tiger encounter shall result in his severe wounds, followed by 6 months of deathly sickness. He shall then forsake his former ways and become a monk. This tale did not impress me. I considered that father had been the credulous victim of a deluded fanatic. The tiger Swami made this confession with an impatient gesture, as though at some stupidity. Grimly silent for a long time, he seemed oblivious of our presence. When he took up the dangling thread of his narrative, it was suddenly, with subdued voice, "Not long after father's warning, I visited the capital city of Cooch Behar. The picturesque territory was new to me, and I expected a restful change. As usual, everywhere, a curious crowd followed me on the streets. I would catch bits of whispered comment. 'This is the man who fights wild tigers. Has he legs or tree trunks? Look at his face. He must be an incarnation of the king of tigers himself.' You know how village urchins function, like final editions of a newspaper. With what speed do the even later speech bulletins of the women circulate from house to house? Within a few hours, the whole city was in a state of excitement over my presence. I was relaxing quietly in the evening when I heard the hoofbeats of galloping horses. They stopped in front of my dwelling place. In came a number of tall, turbaned policemen. I was taken aback. 'All things are possible unto these creatures of human law,' I thought. I wonder if they are going to take me to task about matters utterly unknown to me. But the officers bowed with unwonted courtesy. 'Honoured sir, we are sent to welcome you on behalf of the Prince of Cooch Behar. He is pleased to invite you to his palace tomorrow morning.' I speculated a while on the prospect. For some obscure reason, I felt a sharp regret at this interruption in my quiet trip. But the suppliant manner of the policeman moved me. I agreed to go. I was bewildered the next day to be obsequiously escorted from my door into a magnificent coach drawn by 4 horses. A servant held an ornate umbrella to protect me from the scorching sunlight. I enjoyed the pleasant ride through the city and its woodland outskirts. The royal scion himself was at the palace door to welcome me. He proffered his own gold-brocaded seat, smilingly placing himself in a chair of simpler design. 'All this politeness is certainly going to cost me something,' I thought in mounting astonishment. The prince's motive emerged after a few casual remarks. 'My city is filled with the rumour that you can fight wild tigers with nothing more than your naked hands. Is it a fact?'
'It is, quite true.'
'I can scarcely believe it. You are a Calcutta Bengali, nurtured on the white rice of city folk. Be frank, please. Have you not been fighting only spineless, opium-fed animals?' His voice was loud and sarcastic, his speech tinged with provincial accent. I vouchsafed no reply to his insulting question. 'I challenge you to fight my newly caught tiger, Raja Begum. If you can successfully resist him, bind him with a chain, and depart his cage in a conscious state, you shall have this royal Bengal. Several thousand rupees and many other gifts shall also be bestowed. If you refuse to meet him in combat, I shall blazon your name throughout the state as an impostor.' His insolent words struck me like a volley of bullets. I shot an angry acceptance. Half risen from the chair in his excitement, the prince sank back with a sadistic smile. I was reminded of the Roman emperors who delight in setting Christians in bestial arenas. He said, 'The match will be set for a week hence. I regret that I cannot give you permission to view the tiger in advance.' Whether the prince feared I might seek to hypnotize the beast or secretly feed him opium, I know not. I left the palace, noting with amusement that the royal umbrella and panoplied coach were now missing. The following week I methodically prepared my mind and body for the coming ordeal. Through my servant I learned of fantastic tales. The saint's direful prediction to my father had somehow got abroad, enlarging as it ran.
Many simple villagers believed that an evil spirit, cursed by the gods, had reincarnated as a tiger, which took various demonic forms at night, but remained a striped animal during the